From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here Now.
And Tanya, it is great to have you joining me and Robin as our new co-host today.
It's great to be here. Let's get to the news now. President Trump leaving the White House this morning said he thinks Republicans are ready for what he calls some meaningful gun control measures, including tougher background checks on gun sales. And he says he's spoken with the National Rifle Association leaders about it.
And I really believe that the NRA, I've spoken to them numerous times, they're really good people. They're great patriots. They love our country. They love our country so much. And frankly, I really think they're going to get there also.
Let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable. Margaret Tolove, incoming politics and White House editor at Axios in Washington. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Jeremy. Hi, Tanya.
And Enrique Acevedo is with us as well, anchor at Univision in Miami. Hi, Enrique.
Hi, everyone.
So let's talk about what President Trump just said there. It does sound, Margaret, like maybe we're at a moment when something will actually be able to get through Congress, something meaningful on gun control. Is that your sense?
Hey, Eric. Well, Jeremy, if you just take the president at face value, it certainly sounds like a turning point. But again, I think everyone is sort of proceeding with caution because it's President Trump, and very often and he's made suggestions that something's going to happen and then, you know, backs away or time passes. So there are several weeks, really about a month until Congress is back and running. But again, if you just look at what he said, he himself said that he thinks, he believes that things have changed, that the Senate has changed, that their willingness to act has changed. And we began to see him in his comments there at the departure trying to reframe the debate as rather than being one about gun rights to being one about mental health issues and public safety.
Margaret and Enrique, let's listen to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who told WHAS Radio yesterday that senators, when they reconvene in September, they will be discussing these red flag laws and tougher gun sale background checks, even an assault weapons ban that Republicans have long opposed.
It's certainly one of the front and center issues. I think a lot of other things will come up as well. But what we can't do is fail to pass something.
Where hope goes to Margaret, as you mentioned, there have been stalls. There was House Resolution 8, the bipartisan background check of 2019, back in February.
You bring up
what
the
immigration can pass this time around?
Detention center and,
well,
you know, Orange is the New Black is known.
There's some evidence that Republicans are waiting for the president to take
issues.
Their cues from him. And so I think,
difficult topics,
you know, it certainly doesn't sound like President Trump is willing to support much beyond background checks. Like, there's talk among some Democrats about the assault weapons ban and bringing that back. It doesn't sound like the president is talking about that at all. When you listen to his comments there at the departure, he's talking about some kind of background checks, did not define really what he's talking about. Also, some federal imprint on this red flag laws in individual states where you can sort of, a family member or someone close to someone they're concerned about can flag those concerns, you know, for law enforcement. And then the president also mentioned something about ending the expungement of records for basically high school students who, when they turn 18, you could be a student, your teachers could have a lot of concerns about your mental health or potential violence, and then when you turn 18, those could go away. So this seems to be the world that we're talking about. But look, it's very important to understand, you know, Republicans are waiting to take their cues from the president. And it's one thing for the president to talk about it. It's another thing for the White House to produce a package of suggested legislation to say, this is what the president wants. This is what he wants you to come back and vote on in September. And we don't have any of those details at this point.
And by the way, Enrique, Chuck Schumer, the Senate minority leader, is already saying that if the president needs the NRA's blessing to get something through, then nothing significant will happen. What are your thoughts as you look at all this?
And Amazon, well, I think that public opinion is changing. There's more pressure on politicians to do something, like we saw in Ohio last week. But the elephant in the room in this discussion is that most of the things that are being talked about in Washington wouldn't have prevented what happened in El Paso, what happened in Dayton, what's been happening in this country for the past decade.
Should I be excited for this reunion?
I think activism has to intensify.
Well, you know, if you liked the original show,
and people need at a local level and a national level to tell their politicians they need action that's more ambitious on gun control, common sense gun laws that not only deal with the fact that it's sometimes very easy for people who shouldn't have a gun to get one, but that there are more guns than people in this country. That's going to get in the way of any effort to try to reduce the violence. And also, as border towns like El Paso become the epicenter of the nation's divisive parlay over culture and immigration, the so-called demographic anxieties are being replaced by bullets. And President Trump may have not pulled the trigger, but he was pointing at the target. We need to stop this rhetoric of hate and division, which is also fueling the type of violence that most Americans are denouncing.
Enrique, let's talk a little bit more about that rhetoric. This week, President Trump was greeted by protesters in Dayton and El Paso who blamed him, as you said, for creating a political environment that fosters hate. And just this morning on the White House lawn, he said he condemned all hate, and he kind of listed some names of some hate groups.
We'll stop.
Do you feel that this could be a turning point for him politically? We just read that his approval rating has gone up 10% since 2018, though it's still below 50%. Although there is sentiment there, people upset about the rhetoric. Do you think that this could be a turning point?
I think we're all expecting more from our president.
Thank you. I think my curiosity is going to get the best of me.
The photo ops with the orphan baby.
All right, you're going to let me know what you think.
Yeah, I will. Conducted himself in the past few days.
Yes.
I don't think it's helping national unity and reconciliation.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service.
El Paso represents the changing phase of an America that embraces diversity as a strength. The border, the Walmart store where the attack took place, they're all part of a daily social experiment in which immigration defines national identity instead of threatening it. And that's what America really is. Immigration in America does not threaten national identity. It should define it. And we want to hear the president get behind that idea and I guess, strike a more compassionate tone.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Well, but you've got many of the people who would like to replace him in the election next year calling him a white supremacist. That includes Elizabeth Warren, Beto O'Rourke, Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, although not Joe Biden. Listen.
I believe everything the president says and has done encourages white supremacists. And I'm not sure there's much of a distinction. As a matter of fact, it may be even worse. In fact, if you're out there trying to, in fact, curry the favor of white supremacists or any group that, in fact, is anathema to everything we believe.
Margaret, it seems like this has almost become a litmus test now for the Democratic candidates to say whether they think the president is a white supremacist.
It's a very interesting litmus test if it is that, because on some level it is a primary versus general election strategy. I mean, President Trump is counting on the fact that there are going to be voters who think that Democrats who are calling him a racist or a white supremacist have gone so far that it diminishes them. And it appears that what Joe Biden is trying to avoid is kind of falling into that rut that you condemn the action and that's enough. But there are, of course, those voters inside the Democratic Party who say, you know, why are you dancing around the language? Mm-hmm. Why are you trying to be so careful, with what the president's feelings are ascribing motives to the president? So it has become a litmus test, but Biden is trying to walk back the notion that it should be one. And I think Kamala Harris has been a little bit careful also.
Right. She has not used the words to describe the president.
Yeah. I mean, I think and in both of their thinking is that it's obviously they're not fans of the president. They don't think that the way he's dealt with these issues or using immigration as a wedge issue or to rally the base. They don't support those things and they've condemned him for it. But there's actually a video clip where the former vice president goes after a reporter and basically says, I know what you're trying to get me to say. Why are you trying to get me to say it? Stop trying to get me to say it. I'm telling you that I disagree with his actions. Stop trying to get me to say that word.
Margaret, your news organization, Axios, reports that white supremacists, this accusation actually fires up Trump's base and turns this Main Street Republicans, it could hurt Democrats. What do you actually think about that all of this talk is actually firing up his base?
Well, that is what the president is counting on. But there are some states and some parts of the country where we know that that doesn't work. And so for the president, you know, there's this question, again, of energizing the base versus holding suburban Republicans. And that is really a fundamental concern, maybe to some extent for the president's election results, but certainly for a key group of senators who are standing for re-election in 2020. And for the president, why this matters is because, let's say somehow that he were to get re-elected, but Republicans were to lose control of the Senate, he would be in a world of hurt going forward.
Just in the few seconds we have left here, Enrique, big raid this week in Mississippi, hundreds of undocumented workers arrested. Is that a game changer?
Well, we've been talking about this for a few months, Jeremy, and you know, people may not want to accept it, but the Hispanic community, Hispanic America, is under attack. This happened only a few days after Mexican Americans, mostly Mexican Americans, were under attack in El Paso.
Right.
And now the raids separating families.
That is Enrique Acevedo from Univision and Margaret Tolove, incoming at Axios. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
The suspected gunman who killed 22 people in El Paso wrote online that he was afraid of, quote, a Hispanic invasion of Texas that would push out white Americans. Angry young white men have been responsible for many of the most recent mass shootings in our country. Our next guest has personal experience with white supremacists. He actually was one decades ago. His job now, working as an interventionist of sorts by traveling the country and the world in an attempt to get those mostly men out of hate groups and off of message boards spewing hate. Christian Piccellini is founder of the Free Radicals Project. His upcoming book is called Breaking Hate, Confronting the New Culture of Extremism. Christian, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start with the shootings. So I want to know, what was the first thought that crossed your mind when you heard the motives of the shooter in El Paso, that he was afraid of an Hispanic invasion in Texas?
Well, I was first horrified, like the rest of the world was, upon hearing it. But I have to say, I wasn't surprised that it happened. The rhetoric that I'm hearing today in our society is very similar to the rhetoric that I used to say 30 years ago that was part of our white supremacist neo-Nazi movement. Everything from the words invasion to, you know, the idea that people are going to replace whites. Those are all ideas that I used to spout when I was a neo-Nazi in the 80s and 90s.
Let's talk about you for a moment. You describe your parents as Italian immigrants who were open people, accepting of diversity. What led you to become a neo-Nazi?
Yeah, and that's true. I came from, you know, a loving family that I knew cared about me a lot. But because they were immigrants, they also had to work extremely hard. And they were gone 7 days a week, sometimes 14 or 16 hours a day, just trying to make ends meet. So I grew up really without my parents around, and I felt very abandoned by them, even though I was surrounded by love. So I went searching for a sense of family elsewhere and also a sense of identity and purpose.
You were recruited when you were 14 years old. It was 1987. And as you said, you were searching for a sense of identity. It was a sense of family. What was it like for you being a part of this neo-Nazi group, and what else was it for you?
Well, it absolutely provided camaraderie that I hadn't found in real life until the age of 14 years old. I grew up fairly alienated and bullied. It empowered me at first. It was the first group of people that accepted me as a family that filled me with a sense of purpose. And 14 is a really magical age when it comes to extremism or radicalization. And that's, you know, for far-right groups, or whether it's ISIS or even gangs in inner cities. It's the time when young people are really trying to develop that sense of identity, community, and purpose. They're breaking away from their parents for the first time. And if young people are feeling marginalized or maybe they're vulnerable and they get detoured by what I call potholes, the things in life that we encounter, things like trauma or mental health issues or poverty or joblessness or even privilege, which can keep us in a bubble, those types of things detour people as they're searching for identity, community, and purpose. And on the fringes, there is always somebody with a narrative ready to give it to you and certainly blame somebody else for the pain that you're feeling.
I want to talk a little bit more about how you got out of it. And it's important to talk about this because it's important to say the reason why we're having this discussion is not to make the shooters victims at all, but to really get a deeper understanding of the psychology and what fuels someone who is filled with such hate to kill people. So I want to talk a little bit about how you got out of it. I read that you once owned a record store and a black teenager came in. You guys got to talking about his mother who was suffering from cancer. And that was the first time that you had actually seen black people as human beings?
Yeah, it was, you know, really the first time I had a meaningful interaction with the people that I thought I hated. I opened this record store to sell racist music that I was making and importing. And what I didn't expect to happen was that people would come into my store to buy the other music that I was selling. And you know, those people were black and Jewish and gay. And suddenly I was faced with this humanization that was replacing that challenge. And I bonded with that black teenager because my own mother had been diagnosed with breast cancer. And it was something that we shared aside from everything else that, you know, was filling my head.
Are you suggesting that simply knowing people of color will help angry white men and boys be less racist?
I would certainly never put the burden on people of color to make that happen, nor would I, you know, encourage people who are traditionally victims of racist violence to make that leap. But I can tell you that receiving compassion from the people that we least deserve it from at times, maybe when we least deserve it, is often the most powerful thing. In fact, it might be the only thing I've ever seen truly break hate to overcome that demonization.
Every time there are tragedies like these mass shootings by a racist person, the focus always turns to gun control. I've heard from you in the past say that people with bad intentions will just use other means, bombs, for instance. I want to know what the answer is from your view.
Well, I think we're failing young people. You know, radicalization does not start when somebody finds an ideology. I think that the pre-radicalization stage starts the day we're born, when we start to hit those potholes in the road. And if we can't fill them, we get detoured to very dangerous kind of fringe areas. And I think that we are failing young people in the sense that we are not serving their needs. We're not amplifying their passions. We're not finding the areas to refocus their energy before they find these ideologies. Nobody is born racist. And while, you know, we certainly see the results, the monstrous results of the things that these racists do, you know, in my work, I have to believe that at some point that person was pure and, you know, maybe couldn't find their way. That's my job, to see the child and not the monster, because I have to believe that there are other people like me that, you know, were intercepted at times when they were vulnerable and ultimately could find the right path.
You're doing this work, but how many folks are out there doing this work?
You know, there aren't very many people doing it. And I think that part of the barrier is that most people think that they can't do this work. There needs to be an infrastructure of psychologists, of job trainers, of life coaches, mental health professionals, and mentors who can take over the aftercare with these people, people from their communities who can interface with them one-on-one. I'm a bridge builder, but I certainly, you know, can build that bridge, but I can't build the road after that. That's up to people and the people in their communities to really step in and help. But one of the problems with this is that there has been no focus on far-right extremism in our country ever. And in recent times, any effort to try and analyze the problem has been defunded. And it's very difficult to be able to do this work without being able to train other people to help them understand what some of the strategies can be to do this intervention work with people who are at risk of violent extremism.
After the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017, President Trump famously said that there were very fine people on both sides. You talk about at some point we were all pure, but he got a lot of criticism for saying that. You've also said you see good people who are also white supremacists. Can you explain that?
Yeah, you know, I had an issue as well, as most people do, with what President Trump said when he said there were very fine people on both sides. But there may be people there that it was their first time meeting another white nationalist, that maybe the experience wasn't what they expected. And in fact, I've had many people who attended the Charlottesville rally reach out to me afterwards because they wanted to not be associated with that. It wasn't something that they felt they believed anymore, or at least they were questioning what they believed because of what happened. Now, there were absolutely people there who were intending to cause violence, to cause mayhem, and certainly they're accountable for their actions. But in my work, trying to ensure that people don't go further down that route, I have to provide escape routes for people who are, you know, intentioned on changing and not just trying to skirt the issue.
And what are some of those escape routes?
Well, you know, I do a lot of listening, and I listen for those potholes, and I try and introduce them to the people that they think that they hate, because oftentimes they haven't had those interactions where somebody, you know, goes into a room thinking that they hate somebody else and walking out knowing that they have so much more in common with that person than they have different. It's a very compelling moment to witness.
I think back to your parents, who you say were good people by all accounts, and I'm wondering what they could have done, what other white parents can do to either de-radicalize their children or stop them from going in that direction in the first place. What will you tell them?
That's a really great question. And, you know, people tend to think that what I do is very specialized. And certainly because I am a former extremist, I have, you know, a certain credibility talking with people who are still extremists. But I think all parents, all psychologists, all teachers can do what I do. And that really is just identifying vulnerable young people and then amplifying their passions, trying to fill those voids in their life. Because I've never met a happy white supremacist. I've never met one with positive self-esteem. Everybody in these movements are there because they are broken to a certain degree, and they're looking to project their pain onto somebody else. And I just see my job as kind of a bridge builder to the services that they need. And that's not making excuses for them. I still hold people accountable in many of the same ways I've held myself accountable for 23 years.
Christian Piccolini is founder of the Free Radicals Project. His upcoming book is Breaking Hate, Confronting the New Culture of Extremism. Thank you for joining us, Christian.
Thank you so much.
Uber stock sank this morning after the ride-sharing company posted a $5.2 billion quarterly loss, its largest ever. For more, let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So why is Uber losing this much money?
Well, so the vast majority of that $5.2 billion loss was because the company just went public with an IPO. And what they do is they reward employees with shares of that new stock. That's very common with companies that issue an IPO like Uber did. And Wall Street sort of looks past that number because it's a one-time cost. Mm-hmm. If you subtract that cost for stock-based compensation and a few other things like interest payments and taxes, you get what's called an adjusted loss. And that's really what Wall Street judges them by. That was still pretty big. It doubled to about $656 million. And why are they losing that much money? Well, they're still investing very strongly to grow the company in various markets across the world. So they're willing to sacrifice these short-term losses in the hopes that those investments down the road pay off.
And some of that investment is in the form of subsidies that Uber pays to lessen the costs that we, the consumers, pay for rides. Is Uber ever likely to be in a place where it can eliminate those subsidies?
Yeah, ever, yes. I mean, I think the goal is eventually to get rid of them. In the near future, they're probably here for a while, especially in the food delivery business, which mm-hmm. is hyper-competitive for them. And their main competition, obviously, in the U.S. is Lyft, but there's all sorts of international competition. And they're really using these subsidies to gain that market share, hoping that they will eventually become the biggest player in this ride-sharing industry and sort of drive out some of the weaker competition so that they have more of the business all to themselves.
Well, yeah, here in the U.S., they control 70% of the ride-sharing market. But you mentioned other countries. What kind of competition are they facing abroad?
It's pretty fierce still. Ironically, one of their biggest competitors, it's a Chinese company called Didi Chuxing. Uber actually owns 15% of the company, but that's not stopping Didi from being a very, very fierce competitor to Uber, not just in China, but they're also expanding into Latin America, Mexico and Brazil. They have plans to enter the business in Chile and Colombia, all which are markets for Uber. So despite the fact they do have that relationship, Uber owns a chunk of the company, that's one of their main competitors. So it is a very fierce competitive landscape globally. The executives on the call, CEO Dara Khosrowshahi, said that they do think the competition is easing a little bit, but it's still pretty fierce, obviously.
And just briefly, how is Lyft doing in this country?
So Lyft is still much smaller than Uber. Uber had about $2.9 billion in sales in the quarter. Lyft had about $867 million. But their growth rate is way faster, about 72%. So they're closing that gap pretty quickly.
That is Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, talking with us about Uber, which is looking at stocks in the red today after the company posted, as we said, a $5.2 billion quarterly loss, its largest ever. Mike, thanks as always. Have a great weekend.
You too, Jeremy.
Forty-five years ago today, Richard Nixon became the only president in American history to resign from office.
To continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the president and the Congress.
That resignation and what led up to it is one of the first things many Americans know or remember about the 37th president of the United States. Lately, Nixon's name has been in the news because of a recently discovered exchange he had with then-California Governor Ronald Reagan, in which Reagan describes United Nations delegates from Africa as monkeys.
Those monkeys from those African countries, damn them, they're still uncomfortable wearing shoes.
Well, and then the tail wags the dog there, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The tail wags the dog.
That portion of the infamous Nixon tapes was uncovered last month by a former director of the Nixon Presidential Library. I visited the Nixon Presidential Library and Museum in Yorba Linda, California in October, where resident historian Greg Cumming walked me through part of an exhibit showing the assassinations and unrest that preceded Nixon's election. Cumming says there's a lot more to Nixon's legacy, starting with the fact that he took office during one of the most tumultuous times in American history.
You look at the 60s in turmoil. You have JFK, who's assassinated. You have race riots, one close by here in Los Angeles, the Watts riots. You have a Vietnam War that is really becoming controversial. Not to mention, too, is the assassinations of Martin Luther King, Robert F. Kennedy. So the most controversial time in American history since the Civil War. Why would you want to be president in 1968 is the question. So we get to his inaugural.
The simple things are the ones most needed today if we are to surmount what divides us and cement what unites us. To lower our voices would be a simple thing.
So he's saying he's trying to get America to start listening to each other. Now, does he accomplish that? That's up to the individuals to decide whether he accomplishes that goal or exacerbates it.
If you continue through the museum, you will find the section on Watergate. But Greg Cumming says there was much more to Nixon's legacy than that.
If you are in our research room, there's very little research on Watergate. I think it's a very difficult topic to understand. The opening to China, I think, is a bigger part of his long-term legacy.
Nixon's visit to China even inspired an opera.
I am most proud to welcome you.
What did he do that was so important?
Well, this is a country that since 1949 that we've had absolutely zero relationship with. We were actually fighting with them during the Korean War, if you remember. No embassies, nothing going on. And out of nowhere, seemingly, he announces in 1971 that he'll be visiting Beijing in February of 72. And this was like a lightning bolt out of the blue. And it really changed major power structure quite a bit.
We have at times in the past been enemies. We have great differences today. What brings us together is that we have common interests which transcend those differences.
Although China and the Soviet Union still supplied weaponry to Vietnam, it really made the North Vietnamese a little nervous and gave them a reason also to pursue a negotiated end of the Vietnam War, or I should say the United States version of the Vietnam War.
What's his legacy when it comes to the Vietnam War in general?
That one, I think, is still being written. There are some that will say there are 20,000 casualties during the Nixon administration. What were they there for? But the fact that he was able to find peace and find a way to extricate the United States with a minimum amount of problems, I think is also important and should be part of the equation.
The question at issue is not whether Johnson's war becomes Nixon's war. The great question is, how can we win America's peace?
Current academics probably come down more on the negative side at this moment.
What about Russia, the Soviet Union at the time, and the Cold War?
And detente. If you look at today's world, there's a great deal of confrontation with the other superpowers. Nixon was able to truly lessen that and make it a safer world with his treaty with the Soviet Union regarding strategic arms limitation.
What about his domestic legacy? What are the key elements of his domestic legacy?
This is the one that really doesn't get much notoriety at all, and positively, I'd say. Desegregation of Southern schools. You have his push for the Family Assistance Plan, which was a new type of welfare, which would have guaranteed every American at least a minimal level of income. So there was a number of things that he was involved in, the Philadelphia plan, trying to increase the number of government contracts going to minority-owned business. So he was very active, and it's not seen a lot, clean air, clean water, things of that nature.
The Environmental Protection Agency. Yeah.
The environmental agenda now before the Congress includes laws to deal with water pollution, pesticide hazards, ocean dumping, excessive noise, careless land development, and many other environmental problems.
You'd almost think he was a Democrat in today's world.
Well, you have to remember the politics of two major parties is during the 60s and 70s. Each party had a liberal and a moderate and a conservative wing. So it wasn't like today where one party is absolutely conservative and the other is absolutely progressive. It didn't function like that. In my mind, he was a moderate Republican willing to look at each issue on its own basis and merit.
So that brings us to Watergate, which a lot of people, that's the first word that would come to their mind if they think of Richard Nixon. What was it that gave him that level of insecurity about winning his reelection that led him to do what he did?
I honestly could not. I don't know. In my opinion, I thought he, against George McGovern, he was a slam dunk unless you do something really, really bad. Watergate was not necessary. Now, he's never been tried for the events that happened at Watergate itself, at the Watergate. It was what happened afterwards is what got him in trouble with Congress. And it's up to interpretation, but it was the attempted cover-up.
There have been a lot of stories recently about Watergate because many people are looking at President Trump and saying he better be careful not to repeat the mistakes of Richard Nixon. What do you think about the comparisons?
Well, that, for me, that's, as the historian in me says, you know, they're two different people, apples and oranges, to be honest with you, in completely different times.
Well, what are the lessons from Richard Nixon that would apply today?
I think the lessons are just always keep in mind how important it is to be transparent in government. I think that's one of the key components. You look back to like Ronald Reagan during the Iran-Contra, and he did they had the investigation, and he got up in mea culpa. The American electorate is very forgiving if a mistake has been made, but the American electorate is not very forgiving if they feel that they've been hoodwinked. I think we can look back in American history and say a president who is up front is usually the best policy instead of trying to cover up. You looking back to Lyndon Johnson and what happened in the Vietnam War and the credibility gap that starts there, that's where problems are created.
What is one thing that you think that Americans don't know about Richard Nixon that you know that we ought to know?
Well, most people, I would say, probably don't know that he was raised in a Quaker household, and yet he went against his faith to go fight in World War II because he thought it was so important. He tries in his own way to lessen war, but yet he gets accused of being, to a certain extent, more aggressive with the military. And the second thing, there's one other thing that most people don't know, is that he was extremely helpful to Native Americans and signed legislation that improved their lives and continues to be very popular on Indian reservations today.
Our Indian people, who are a small part of America in numbers, have made an enormous contribution because they have given great character to so many parts of our country.
Signed back land to the Native Americans. So most people would never associate Richard Nixon with Native Americans.
Greg Cumming, staff historian at the Nixon Presidential Library and Museum in Yorba Linda, California. We spoke in October. Today marks 45 years since the resignation of President Richard Nixon. We've got photos from our visit at hereandnow.org.
It's also the end of an era for Netflix. Orange is the New Black released its seventh and final season. We get to see some of the show's most popular characters try to adapt to life outside of prison.
You can't pretend that prison just didn't happen.
No, but I'm not going to spend the rest of my life looking back on it either. I did my time. I'm looking forward now.
That's Orange is the New Black. But if you're ready for some 90s nostalgia, Beverly Hills 90210 returned to Fox this week. With more, we're joined with NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hey, Eric.
Hi.
Okay, let's start with Orange is the New Black. And for those who don't know, it's a long-running drama based on a character named Piper who ends up in prison after she committed a crime and it catches up with her. But it's so much more than Piper. Through these last six seasons, we've been taken on this dynamic, complex journey of prison life through all of these cast of characters. This last season, before this final season, however, many folks were saying that it was so meandering. And I want to know from you, what should we take away from this final season, and how does it weigh in comparison?
Well, I feel like they've done an amazing job of sort of re-engaging the narrative and bringing the show in for a landing in a way that feels really significant. Some of the characters wind up in an immigrant detention center, and we get a lot of scenes that show the very stark difference between being in one of those places, which is in a way much worse than being in jail, and what it's like to be in a regular facility. And through it all, you always get this sense that even among the guards and the people who are supposed to be in charge, that the prison is a sort of prison for them too. And so we see them struggling with existing in this place where hope goes to die often. And we will see, you know, a key character die towards the end of the last season in a way that wraps up the story very neatly.
Yeah, you bring up the Immigrations and Custom Enforcement Detention Center. And, you know, Orange is the New Black is known for taking on criminal justice issues. How do you think the show has addressed these difficult topics overall during its run?
Well, you know, this show primarily is about humanizing the kind of people that we normally would rather not think about. So the women who are in this jail, we get to know them on a very human way. And some of the most poignant scenes have been when the narrative goes back to show us how some of these ladies wound up in jail. A drama like Orange is the New Black can really bring you into their world and make you see what it's like for people who ultimately are as human as you or I.
Well, Orange is the New Black is a Netflix original, and last quarter Netflix actually lost subscribers. And now we hear lots of stories about Amazon, Apple, and soon Disney giving the company a run for its money. What do you think Netflix has in the works that could draw viewers the way Orange is the New Black did and some of those other original shows?
Well, I think that's the $64,000 question. I mean, as Orange is the New Black goes off the air with its final season, there's a lot more competition in the streaming space. And Netflix's problem is that the shows that are sort of the core of its subscriber base, shows like The Office and Friends that were created by other TV providers, they're clawing those shows back. And so Netflix has to create originals that are just as popular with its subscribers as those shows, and they have not been able to do that so far. I think they have a big challenge, especially as Disney and Amazon and Hulu and Apple TV Plus, they're all spending a lot of money to try and come up with these big, broad shows that will also draw subscribers.
Hmm. Okay, now let's turn to BH90210, a return to the hit 90s series Beverly Hills 90210, which, Eric, was my jam back in the 90s. Should I be excited for this reunion?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, if you liked the original show, you might like this. I guess they're calling it a reboot. The people on the show are calling it a reboot. Basically, the actors from the show are playing fictionalized versions of themselves, and they're all considering participating in a reunion of the 90210 cast at a convention, and then later a reboot TV series.
Meta,
and,
very meta.
It's extremely meta. They seem to be trying to be funny and cute. They mostly missed the mark for me. We've got a clip of the show, and it features Tori Spelling, Ian Ziering, and Jenny Garth kind of arguing with each other. They're on a plane. They're about to leave this convention where all the actors have gotten back together again. Tori is talking about how she doesn't have money, despite the fact that she's the daughter of the guy who created the show. So let's check it out.
I have six mouths to feed.
How could you grow up with every advantage in life and still struggle to support your kids? It's mind-boggling to me.
Okay, it's not Tor's fault that she lacks basic life skills. I mean, she's not normal. She can't function in a normal environment. It's like letting a zoo animal out into the wild.
Really? I was sticking up for you. Well, stop.
So that's the example of the humor. So, you know, if your dream was to see fictionalized versions of these actors making fun of each other, this show is for you.
Yeah, sadly, Luke Perry is not a part of this. He's passed
that's
away
true.
This past, a few months ago. That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Thank you. I think my curiosity is going to get the best of me. I got to check out this new 90210.
All right, you're going to let me know what you think.
Yeah, I will. Thank you.
I already told you what I think.
Yes. Thanks so much for joining us.
All righty. Bye.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.